We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. Today's class is The Stars Are Bright with our guest, astronomer Jane Bright. On today's episode, Emily Strand and I are talking with Jane Bright about astronomy in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2 and Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competence at Mount Carmel College, and co-editor of Star Wars, Essays Exploring a Galaxy Far, Far Away, and co-editor of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
I am looking to get educated today, Emily.
Oh, same. Really, educated. I'm always looking to get educated, yeah. Katie.
That's what I love about our podcast also. I feel like I'd learn stuff all the time.
Yes.
I miss being a student in some ways. Well, we are going to learn about one of the most important mysteries in the Department of Mysteries. Space, and how we know what's out there and how it affects us here on Earth. And it's, of course, relationship to Harry Potter. So, right. Emily, did you ever take an astronomy class?
No, I never did. I'm not even sure there one was offered. I think there was one offered, but I was warned away from it as like fulfilling the science requirement because people told me it was more like astrophysics, and that sounded a lot scarier than astronomy. So I think I signed up for biology instead. Did you?
I did not either. Okay. We're going to gain some education here.
Yeah, we need the help.
Yeah. But the college that I teach at now has a planetarium and an astronomer, and I have really benefited from going to that. And
That's cool.
Always feel like it's almost, Emily, you will get this, it's almost a spiritual experience to me, contemplating the vastness of the universe and how amazing it is that our knowledge of it has grown exponentially, you know, just in the last few hundred years. And I just think it's so exciting. I always feel really inspired by it.
That reminds me of a lot of themes of like Ray Bradbury stories. And I just finished reading Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents by Octavia E. Butler, which were phenomenal. And it's so interesting that the religious, you know, group that the main character seeks to found, like their ultimate destination is not heaven, but the heavens, you know, like they want to go and spread the sort of seed of humanity in the stars, which is a really interesting way of thinking about space.
Yeah, really interesting. That's also a Star Trek Deep Space Nine thing, Emily.
Oh, totally. Totally.
So,
no spoilers. I'm on season
five. Right.
I'm
okay,
in season
okay.
six, actually. Season
All right.
Six, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I shouldn't
no spoilers.
Have said anything. Well,
no, it's good.
Our professor in Harry Potter astronomy, who's going to give us a good education today, is Jane Bright. She earned bachelor's degrees in math and physics and minored in astronomy at Denison University in Ohio. Woo! She is now at the University of Arizona, where she has earned her master's degree in astronomy and astrophysics and her certificate in college teaching. She's now a PhD candidate in astronomy and astrophysics. Her research focuses on studying the gravitational dynamics around supermassive black holes through computer simulations. Fascinating. This summer, Emily and I were so delighted by Jane's presentation on astronomy and Harry Potter at LeakyCon in Chicago that we invited her to come on the show and share her ideas with listeners. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. And thanks for coming and talking to me at LeakyCon. That was an absolute blast.
Yeah, that was fun. That was such a good session. And
It was.
I mean, Emily and I, you were not even 5 minutes in, and Emily's like, we have to have her on the show.
It was so great. It was so well put together. The ideas flowed, one to the next. And it was just, I was like, oh, this is going to be great.
It to me, it was the perfect blend of like actual astronomy science and actual Harry Potter. I was like, this is exactly what we like on Potterversity.
Yes. When I told my friends that I was coming on this podcast, I'm like, it's a Potter Studies podcast. So it's a bunch of academic nerds talking about Harry Potter. And they're like, oh, those seem like your people. You should totally do
Yes,
that.
we recognized you as our people straight away, Jane. Welcome, welcome. Well, Jane, how did you first encounter the Harry Potter books, and when did you start to think about them in relation to your field of astronomy?
Yeah, so I am one of the lucky people who got to encounter the Harry Potter series as a child. So when I was a kid, I was a very kind of airy fairy child. I was kind of off on my own plane of existence, filled with fairies and stardust and fantasy.
That sounds
So I loved
awesome.
it was a great time. So I loved fantasy and I loved magical worlds and stories. And of course, I loved bookstores. So I have a really clear memory when I was about 7 years old of going into Barnes and Noble in Boulder, Colorado, where I grew up, and it had just been taken over by Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. It was everywhere. There was displays. It had become a Harry Potter store. And it was at that point that I asked my parents, "Hey, will you start reading me this Harry Potter series?" And that became my lifelong love of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. So then, flash forward a few years, the seventh book came out in the summer. I was on a camping trip with my dad. I insisted that we go into town, though I really don't think that was up for debate to go get the seventh Harry Potter book, and then just devoured that over the next couple of days.
Of
So then,
course. Of course you
of
have to do that.
course. So I have very fond memories of sitting next to a creek in Montana reading the seventh Harry Potter book, finishing it by flashlight. In my tent, all of that.
I just wanted to say how cool it would be to read, especially book seven, in a tent. Because I feel like,
Oh, yeah, that's on point. Yeah.
on point.
Right.
So then at the end of that summer, I entered sixth grade, and it was that year that I had my first class on astronomy in school. And I think maybe astronomy felt like a real world echo to my far off magical imaginings. And so after taking this class, I became really enamored with astronomy. I found this documentary series about astronomy on TV and I watched every single episode of it. And it was at that time that I decided that I wanted to grow up to be an astrophysicist. And what's not lost on me is I made that declaration when I was 11. So at the same age that I fell in love with science and astronomy, it was the same age that Harry was introduced to magic and entered the Wizarding World. So that parallel has always felt really significant to me.
That's so cool.
Yeah. You found your magic at age
Exactly.
11. Yeah. And I mean, I honestly think it's such a significant age for those kinds of discoveries. I would love to hear from a lot of people like when they discovered their real, vocation, especially when it's so clear. I have a lot of students, I teach at a nursing college, and a lot of them knew from a very young age that they wanted to be nurses. And I do kind of wonder if it's that formative, time when you're just leaving elementary school, entering middle school. And yeah, there's a lot of magic right there. That's neat that it resonated kind of that way for you too.
Yeah. So what do we know about how astronomy class works at Hogwarts? So, and I don't know if you were making mental comparisons as you were taking astronomy as an 11-year-old, but like what are they doing? Because they do have astronomy class, which is, among all of the stranger courses that they have, ancient runes, divination is an actual astronomy class. So what are they teaching there?
Yeah, I always like pointing out, since I am a student of astronomy and astrophysics, that astronomy is the only class that is taught both at the University of Arizona, where I currently attend, that is also taught at Hogwarts. So yeah,
Awesome.
I always love leading with that. So we know that astronomy at Hogwarts is actually a required course. So it's a course they start taking in their first year, and they're required to take it up through their fifth year through their OWL exams. So it's part of that core curriculum right off the bat at Hogwarts. And we never actually see them take an astronomy class. It's referenced a lot. We see them study for it, do homework for it. But we never actually see them in an astronomy class, either in the movies or the books. Though we do get to see them take their OWL exam in the books. But we can kind of gather through their references that they're learning things like names and positions of stars, motions of stars and planets, lunar phases. There's a lot about star charts and filling in star charts. They learn about moons around other planets. And of course, they're using telescopes to make telescope observations all the time. But this isn't actually a lot of information. So there's a lot of room there for kind of interpretation and imagining. And so, as an astronomer myself, I have a lot of theories about what I think might be going on in that class and why that class exists as a class at Hogwarts.
Oh, please share. Share your theories.
Well, one of the things that I like to point out is that when we think about magic in relating to stars in our kind of ordinary muggle world, we often think of astrology. So we might imagine that at a wizarding school like Hogwarts, that if there's an astronomy class, what they're primarily learning is astrology. But I also like to point out that they do learn astrology at Hogwarts, but they learn it in their divination class. So astrology is a section of divination, and divination is not a required course. That's an elective course that they can take up in year three at Hogwarts. And so to just say, well, astronomy is just laying the groundwork so that they can learn astrology later, also doesn't really make sense because not everyone is going to take divination. Not everyone is going to learn astrology at Hogwarts. So there must be something kind of deeper going on as to why does astronomy get its own dedicated course. So I also like to kind of like tease out what are the differences between astrology and astronomy,
Oh,
right?
yes, good, because that was my next question.
Oh, wonderful.
Please go.
Getting educated. We're getting educated.
Love it.
So originally, these two fields were probably very related. So astronomy is really looking at how do things move outside of Earth's atmosphere, right? How do things move? And then coming up with the physical mechanisms for that motion to kind of explain it from maybe from a physics perspective over time. While astrology is really trying to make predictions about things that are going to happen here on Earth based off of those motions of the heavens. So very early on, those two might be very related. And it would make sense that they're related because there are things in the sky that do affect us. The motion of the moon is related to our tides. The position of the sun gives us our seasons. The rising of a certain star for the first time in the year might mark the beginning of those seasons. So that interconnectedness is really there. But at some point, those split, and astronomy became a more scientific endeavor with predictable outcomes. And astrology kind of stayed in this kind of fortune-telling aspect. And so those kind of broke apart. So modern astrology that we've probably all heard of has a lot to do with your zodiac sign. So I'm going to ask you guys, do you know what your star sign is?
Oh, yes, I'm an air sign. I'm a Gemini.
I'm a Leo.
Excellent. A Leo.
Do you
Geminis and
happen to?
Leos get along well.
Yeah, I know. I love Geminis. Big fan. My son
No,
is a Gemini.
it's such a good
Yeah.
podcast.
Yeah,
Yeah. I hope so.
Jane, what are
We
you?
never fight. We never
What's your
fight, Jane
sign?
and
What's your sign, Jane?
I. So I'm an Aries.
Oh,
Ooh. No,
yeah,
I'm
no, these
kidding.
are
I'm
all good.
kidding.
All three of these are good together.
So do you happen to know what makes your sun sign your sun sign?
It has something to do with what the star chart is on the day that you're born and like where the things are they ascendant? I don't really know. I'm just going from
I thought it sounded
ascendant,
pretty good.
right? Something like that, you know, where what the arrangement is and what's ascending and so on. Am I close, Jane?
Yeah, so your star sign is supposedly the constellation that the sun was in the sky on the day you were
Oh.
born. Right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so all of the zodiac signs are just the constellations that the sun passes through at some point in the year. So they're this all the constellations that lie in the plane of our solar system. So the plane that the Earth goes around the sun in, if you extended that out, all of those constellations that that would intersect are the zodiac constellations.
Cool.
But here's the fun kind of fact, is that over time, the orientation of Earth's axis wobbles a little bit. So from the time when those zodiac constellations were given dates to be given sun signs, the Earth's orientation has wobbled a little bit. So I said I'm an Aries. I give that a little bit of a caveat because that's based on an old schedule. So even though I say I'm an Aries, the sun was actually in the constellation of Pisces on the day I was born.
Plot thickens.
The plot thickens.
I don't like the wobble. Jane, I'm anti-wobble.
So you said you're a Gemini?
Yes.
So this is your homework, is go look up. You can use an app or a planetarium software or something like that. You can even go visit your planetarium, talk to your local astronomer, and see what constellation was the sun actually in on the day you were born.
Okay.
Because you might actually be a Taurus.
Oh. I don't identify with that at all, Jane. In my fortune telling divination kind of world.
Crisis of confidence here. You heard it first.
Yeah, I'm having an identity crisis for sure.
I want to say, I almost had an identity crisis over this because I heard about that a few years ago and I went and did some research because, like, I'm very much a Leo. I'm very much a Gryffindor and I'm very much a Leo. Uh-huh. And I'm an Enneagram 8. It all goes together, in my opinion. And
is a lion-esque figure also an Enneagram 8 icon?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
You have a lot of
maybe. But I think I remember looking it up a few years ago and I was like, whew, because I was still a Leo. I should probably check.
Yeah, if you're on the edges, you might be okay. You might be safe.
Yes, because mine is the 24th of July. So I was kind of right on the cusp anyway. Like it had just turned Leo when I was born. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because my sisters were both born on August 10. And so we're all three Leos. And like, look out. Like, Here we come. Watch out.
Pack of your
defenders
lions
of the week.
Yeah.
Now, Jane, I do know, and this is not a question I had planned to ask. It's not even really a question, but I do know in my studies, because I teach comparative religions, and I do know that for Hindus and for other, you know, some Eastern religions, astrology is actually really important to the point where, like in a healthcare setting, you do, you know, some patients will schedule births at certain auspicious times because they want to observe those, the zodiac, you know, pattern for their child. So it is, I find it really interesting what you're saying about how that piece of the study of the heavens is placed in divination, because it's almost has a religious, you know, a connotation to it, more so than a scientific connotation. You think that's fair to say?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would say so. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that one of the ways it was linked in like the pre-modern thought was through what's called the great chain of being, that suggested that in the Christian worldview, that the heavens and the earth were all connected to each other through the great chain of being. And of course, how can you see what's a field through which you could read signs of what might happen just here on lowly earth? Well, you could kind of look at the field of the heavens because it's all connected together. So there was this idea that they were all united together. And then the scientific revolution kind of, like you said, Jane, it's like, well,
there's a split.
That's not really what we think we're doing over here. So
you go your way, we'll go our way.
That's right. That's right.
Let us know how that works out.
So let's get a little bit more into this. Like, why do you think Hogwarts teaches astronomy as a school subject, Jane? Like, why would they do that? How does that fit into a magical education?
Now we get to go into some of Jane's personal favorite fan theories.
Oh, super. Bring it.
So I think it's likely that when Hogwarts was founded, astronomy and astrology were probably the same subject. And so they were put into the core Hogwarts curriculum from its very founding. And then as there was kind of a split in the Muggle world between astronomy and astrology, that split was also kind of observed within the Hogwarts curriculum. So astrology kind of found its place within the field of divination, but then astronomy was a standalone. And so I have two theories about why I think astronomy might be a good course to teach at a wizarding school like Hogwarts. And my first is that maybe astronomy is actually just taught as a science in its own right, that we see that they're not really learning like math and English and science that we think of as Muggle subjects at Hogwarts, that maybe astronomy is actually where they're getting some of that, that astronomy is a place where they can learn scientific reasoning, basic mathematics, observational skills. But because it's connected to the heavens, it has this kind of sense of wonder and magic attached to it, more than maybe other fields of science that they could be teaching. And since astronomy is kind of on the edge of what can be known for humanity, it's a great place for magic and wizards to kind of explore in a scientific sense.
So what I like about what you're saying, especially, is, you know, this notion that there is a like profound quality to examination of the stars or the heavens, whether you're doing it as a spiritual practice or a scientific practice. And that just relates to what I said at the beginning to my Absolutely. Way of thinking about how I find it to be. It shows you your smallness, and it gets you thinking about something larger than yourself, and that would be useful whether you're a wizard or a Muggle.
Absolutely. And I definitely feel that deeply myself as an astronomer as well. So then my second theory of why astronomy might be worthy of being taught at Hogwarts is that maybe it's a basis for more kind of ritual magic. We see when we think of magic in the Harry Potter universe, we mostly think of wand waving and incantations and spell casting. But we also see some examples of this more kind of like ritualistic magic, that maybe knowing the positions of stars and planets and that kind of thing could be really important for that aspect of magic.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool too. And one of the things I think is interesting is I think J.K. Rowling dabbled a little bit in star charts and astrology, and that she might be like, is she refusing those together in a kind of way? You know, as you think about magic, and they're doing magic, right? So maybe the magic and actual astronomical knowledge need to be paired together, so they're not like accidentally doing things when they think Leo is in the chart, but it's really Virgo. What comes?
Right.
I don't know what the order there is, but right, so that there's real knowledge that they can, on which they can base their magic. Cool.
Yeah. Right. And I was just going to say, it also kind of makes it, the curriculum as a whole, seem harder, not as in difficulty, but as in, you know, kind of substantive, you know, it just kind of lends like a legitimacy to it, to the average modern reader.
But Jane, how are they doing real astronomy if they never take math class? Because Emily, you are not wrong. The rumors were not wrong. Like, astronomy does require some math.
It does. So that goes to my first theory, that astronomy is actually the avenue through which they are learning math. Probably something that they want to learn. So maybe part of astronomy class is actually learning some basics of mathematics and geometry.
They're doing some Alex lessons. You know, they got to do some iReady every week.
Oh, gosh. That's how they teach math now, Jane. Through these computer systems. I'm with you, Emily. Yep.
Jane, you did a great job of starting to answer my next question about this business of ritual magic. What are the, you know, how is this, how can we think of this as ritual magic? What are other forms of ritual magic that we have in Harry Potter?
Yeah, absolutely. So in thinking about ritual magic, I like to start thinking about the magic that we see most prominent in the Harry Potter series, which is our spell casting. But then to look at the actual curriculum at Hogwarts and see that most of the classes are actually not spellcasting based. So we have our spellcasting kind of based classes, which are Charms, Transfiguration, and Defense Against the Dark Arts. But then we have all of our other classes that really aren't based off of wand waving and incantation. So we have Astronomy, Potions, Herbology, History of Magic. Then if we get into some of our elective courses, we have Ancient Runes, Arithmancy, Care of Magical Creatures, Divination, Muggle Studies, maybe even Alchemy for some of our advanced students. But all of those courses are really not looking at here's how you wave a wand and cast a spell. And so really looking at this wider aspect of what is magic. And one of my favorite quotes to this is the first time we see Snape in a potions class. And he has this quote of, as there's very little foolish wand waving here, many of you will hardly believe that this is magic. But that actually most of the magic they learn isn't that foolish wand waving.
Right. It's so, almost like Defense Against the Dark Arts is like maybe Transfiguration, but I'm struggling to think of other applications for the wand waving.
Yeah, I like that idea that, right, so the ritual magic, these are things that you're doing that are not, you know, like in the moment, I'm making my spell, I'm waving my wand. Like you would have to do that in a duel, right? But the ritual magic requires a lot of preparation, thought, like potions, for example.
Yeah. And so we see some, I think, great examples of this kind of more ritual magic, exactly as you were just saying, kind of non-instantaneous magic, magic that takes some kind of planning and setup and like longer thought.
It's like process magic.
Process, yeah. I like that, yeah.
Process magic, yeah.
So we see that when we hear about, there's kind of a ritual by which one can become an animagus requires over a month's worth of kind of constant processing that is part of this ritual. We don't really get to see this, but there's kind of a ritual around Horcruxes. That's not just a spell one cast to make a Horcrux. Voldemort's re-embodiment at the end of the fourth book is another great example of a ritual. There's not really a spell cast there.
I always react like that.
Right. Well, they call it a dark mass, right?
Yeah, I know. John Granger calls it a black ritual mass. Yeah. And that's a good term for, I mean, it really is. That's apt.
And then another place where we actually get to see it actively done, perhaps in a less dark way, is when Dumbledore and Harry enter the cave at the end of Half-Blood Prince searching for a Horcrux. And they enter and Dumbledore just enters the space and just says, this place has known magic. And he walks around and he kind of mutters in tongues under his breath and touches things. And Harry has this moment of saying, I've never seen magic done like this, not by spell casting, but through touch and look. We get to see some of this other aspects of magic that Dumbledore is performing that go beyond the things that we have seen taught at Hogwarts. So I like to think that perhaps astronomy is kind of laying the basis for those deeper ritualistic aspects of magic in the Harry Potter universe.
So I don't know if this is the case. I should have gone back and looked this up, but Polyjuice Potion, don't you have to do it in certain phases? I mean, isn't there some astronomical or astrological thing that you have to do with Polyjuice Potion? Some listener can correct me on that if I'm wrong.
Yes, listeners, please write in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So moon phases are one of the places that we see it come up the most. So Polyjuice Potion has to be brewed for a whole lunar cycle. There are ingredients. I think Fluxweed has to be picked at the full moon to be put into Polyjuice Potion. Veritas Serum also has to be brewed for a whole lunar cycle. Wolfsbane is connected to that lunar cycle. So there's lots of things in potions that are very connected to those moon phases.
Yeah.
As well as the animagus ritual requires that you hold a mandrake leaf in your mouth for a whole lunar cycle.
Oh my gosh.
Hassle.
Imagine Sirius and James doing that. Come on. That's funny. I need some fan fiction on that.
I do too.
I'm sure it's out there.
I heard this. It was a tweet or something a couple of years ago, and it was somebody who was making fun of like some of the instructions that people give you when you're checking out of your Airbnb. You know, like, you know, put all the cups facing the same direction in the cabinet when you're done using them, and then hold a freshly killed goose up to the naked moon for 10 minutes. I was like, sometimes it is kind of like that.
That's funny. Oh gosh, yes, but I mean, I think that is, it is this idea of ritual, that ritual is supposed to be protective, it's supposed to be able to help you to achieve something, just the performance of a ritual. And I think it actually is associated with trying, I don't mean to offend anybody, but with some kind of OCD stuff, like all the cups have to be facing in the
No,
right
yeah, I
direction.
think,
There's a
well,
ritual quality
it's
to that.
very rules based. It's very rules based, and it is, you know, I mean, I've made this argument other places that even really the foundation for all the magic in Harry Potter is very sacramental in the sense that it combines this, you know, uttered word or words, with this natural sign, you know, of either the wand or these other things that Jane has brought up. And so there is this kind of sacramental ritual quality to really most of it. But I think we do see that with all these examples that Jane's brought up most clearly. And another one I thought of is when Harry casts the Sectum Sempra curse at Draco, and Snape has to fix him, you know, and Snape is doing something that sounds like singing to Harry's ears, and it's a process too. It's not instantaneous. It takes a while, you know, for him to fix those wounds. And I think I just find that a really interesting way of portraying the matter. I've always found that it was really interesting, and I think a lot of people are drawn to it as well because it's a very powerful way to depict what magic is and what it does, and maybe even what ritual is and what it does.
Yeah, cool. Well, Jane, do we see astronomy playing other roles in magic in the series? We talked some about moon phases, but where else do we see astronomy coming into the magic?
One of my favorite examples is actually in the very first chapter of the first book when Dumbledore is bringing Harry to the Dursleys, and they say that he has a watch and he's checking the watch because Hagrid is late, but it's not an ordinary watch. It's a watch with stars and planets moving along its face instead of hands and numbers. But clearly he understands it because he's able to say right after that that Hagrid is running late. So there's some aspect there. A reader could just say, well, he's weird, and that's how he tells time is based off of the position of the planets. But coming from this perspective of astronomy and ritual magic, I really like to think that it goes beyond just telling the time, but also to say, what are the positions of stars and planets for this really kind of powerful moment that's about to occur, right? That as he places Harry on the doorstep of the Dursleys, he's putting into place this kind of deep ritual magic of this blood protection of Lily's blood, Lily's family. And so noting the positions of the stars and planets at that moment might be really significant to maybe hearken back to later in some sort of ritual magic, or just knowing what that is could be a powerful thing from that perspective.
Yeah, my husband likes to say that Dumbledore sees deeply into time. And I think that's kind of interesting because, of course, when you're looking at the stars, you are looking back in time in an
Absolutely.
important way. And so that he's maybe using that as a kind of expansive way to understand time itself. Wow, that's cool.
Oh, that's a paper right there. Tell
Jane.
Davey's got to get on it.
Oh, Dave, I was like,
Yeah.
Jane, you could write this.
Yeah. Dave might want you to, Jane.
We could collaborate.
Sure.
And then another place that we see kind of space come up in terms of magic is in the Ministry of Magic in the Department of Mysteries. So as they're running around the Department of Mysteries, trying to save Sirius, trying to save the prophecy, running away from all the Death Eaters, they see some of these aspects of magic that are considered the most mysterious and secret. And space is on there. So we have a space room, we have a time room, we have a love room, we have a death room. So some of these like really deep aspects that are being studied secretly. So knowing that then space is one of those things that's being studied in the Department of Mysteries also kind of lends some thought to me that space and astronomy is somehow deeply related to the maybe the foundational nature of magic itself.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Right.
Yeah.
I find the Department of Mysteries really, really interesting. Not that we see much of it, but as you say, Jane, it just opens up the possibility for all kinds of theories that we might develop.
Right. Yeah. All kinds of theories and all kinds of, I mean, it would be a great place for more stories too, in terms of, you know, following the research or following, you know, the pursuit of knowledge, you know, in those, I don't know. That's the kind of nerdy Harry Potter, you know, stories that I would want myself, but.
Absolutely.
So how is, from your observations, how is wizard astronomy different from our muggle astronomy? Do wizards seem more or less knowledgeable than us in this area?
Yeah, so wizards seem to have less modern astronomical instrumentation, right? So their telescopes seem much more old-fashioned than the telescopes that we use today as muggles. But perhaps that's not entirely surprising, because most of the things wizards use are not as kind of modern as the things we use as muggles. They still use quills instead of pens, so that kind of thing.
Right. Fair enough.
But I also know that they have to be somewhat paying attention. So there's the idea that the statute of secrecy came in, and maybe that's when we closed the door between wizard and muggle knowledge being passed. But some notes to see that perhaps that wasn't entirely true for the field of astronomy is that wizards seem to be up to date on some astronomical discoveries that came into place after the implementation of the statute of secrecy, and particularly the discovery of the outer planets or dwarf planets. So the discovery of Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto all happened after the statute of secrecy came into place. So there has to be at least some conversations going on between wizard astronomers and muggle astronomers. And this also brings me back to this idea of the Ministry of Magic and the Department of Mysteries, that we know that wizards that work in the Department of Mysteries are called unspeakables, that maybe the unspeakable aspect of working in the Department of Mysteries as someone working in that space room is actually that they're staying connected to muggle knowledge. So it's unspeakable because you're actually collaborating with muggles.
Ooh,
I like that.
Controversial. Yeah. Mm.
Right. And the statute of secrecy thing, Katie, wasn't it David Martin who kind of laid out that it's maybe not so much information that got cut off then, but rather like technology borrowing that got sort of cut off in that time. So that may help explain some of the knowledge, the modern knowledge that they seem to have, but not their instruments, you know. But I do also like this theory about something happening in the Department of Mysteries, maybe in all these areas, where some people are much more connected to the muggle world than their counterparts on the outside.
Interesting. Underground muggle spy network.
Right.
Department of Mysteries, Section 31. I made a Star Trek joke. I'm so proud.
So what can we infer about members of the Black family based on their astronomical names? They, you know, all the Black family members seem to have something to do with, you know, the heavens, the stars, but that, you know, knowing J.K. Rowling, like, there has to be something that she's trying to tell us with those choices.
Oh, absolutely. This is actually one of my favorite aspects of how astronomy is directly represented in the Harry Potter series, is that all of these names, largely in the Black family, come from these kind of celestial sources. And I'm sure you've noticed that many of the characters in the Harry Potter series have names that seem a little on the nose. For example, Remus Lupin.
Right.
Both of those are referring to his kind of wolf-like nature, right?
Yeah.
So I remember there's an article I read back on Pottermore that kind of explained why there's kind of these a little too accurate names that came from naming seers that parents in the wizarding world could go see one of these naming seers who would kind of give a prophecy and help you name your child based off of something that was going to be true about that child in their life. So many of these astronomical names in the Black family, we can see that really directly, which I think is cool. So one of the ones that probably is most clear that if you've thought about this, that you might have noticed for yourself is obviously Sirius. So Sirius Black. Sirius is the dog star. It's the brightest star in the Canis Major constellation, which is the dog constellation. Also brightest star in the sky. Sirius, obviously being an animagus, turns into a black dog. So Sirius Black is a black dog. Very clear.
Yeah, I love that too, because think about how what you described about the animagus ritual magic having some connection to moon phases, and that maybe there's a like part of the reason he becomes this dog, right, has to do with some, you know, that these things are all kind of working together somehow.
Now, there's many of these. I'll kind of like try to keep it to my favorites here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could tell us, you could tell us all of them, right? But so, go ahead, like especially like like what about Regulus?
Yeah, so Regulus Arcturus Black, Sirius's brother. So we know that Regulus was kind of a good member of this Slytherin family. He ultimately became a Death Eater, which from the perspective of the Blacks was probably something very respectable, but then ultimately betrayed the Dark Lord and stole the Horcrux, right? So this kind of arc of Regulus's life. So Regulus, the name can mean little king or prince, kind of leaning into that idea that he's kind of the prince of this very Slytherin pureblood family, right? But another meaning for Regulus, because Regulus is the brightest star in Leo, which we were talking about earlier, the lion constellation, is that Regulus is sometimes referred to as the heart of the lion. So that ultimately Regulus had this lion-hearted bravery to go against the darkness and to his own demise, do what was right in the end and show that bravery and courageousness. So I like this. Both of those meanings are in that name.
That's go awesome.
Leo. Go Leo.
So excited.
And then one of my other favorites, which is perhaps a little more obscure, is Alfred. So Alfred is Sirius's uncle. I think we see him mentioned in exactly one scene in the books as he's showing Harry the Black family tapestry, that family tree, and showing, so and going through it and telling the story of how he, Sirius, ran away and went off to live with the Potters for some time, but that his uncle Alfred gave him some money and was and kind of helped him escape the Black family. So Alfred is the brightest star in the constellation Hydra, and it also has a kind of dual meaning. So it's the backbone of the serpent coming from that constellation Hydra, again, referring to the Black family as this very proud Slytherin family, backbone of the serpent. But Alfred also means the individual. So he was supporting Sirius in that kind of individual nature in being able to leave that Black family.
Our editor, Emma Nicholson, will love this because she talks about Sirius. Actually, in the Potterversity book, her essay is about Sirius, and she talks about what he was able to do with the help of Uncle Alfred. So that's great.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
That fits perfectly.
Emma, that one's for you.
And then, of course, there's many others. So there's Bellatrix, who is the female warrior star. There's Draco Malfoy, who's also descended from the Black family. Draco is the dragon or the serpent, again, leading to Draco being the very good Slytherin student. So lots of good kind of mythology in there. Of course, then there's also Andromeda, who becomes Andromeda Tonks, which is Nymphadora Tonks' mother. My cat is also named Andromeda, so I have a special place in my heart for her. Nice. Lots of good stellar mythology in those names in the Black family.
Yeah.
That's great because it's not only an astronomy reference, but it's also a Harry Potter reference. So,
of course, I love
it. Perfect.
Well, this is fascinating. Jane, what other characters have astronomical or astrological associations?
One of my favorite kind of celestially sourced names in the Harry Potter series is actually Merope. So Merope Gaunt, so Voldemort's mother. Merope comes from the name of a star in the Pleiades. So the Pleiades is an open cluster of stars, sometimes referred to as the Seven Sisters, which I always love from an astrophysics perspective too, because these actually are sister stars. They're close together in that cluster because they were born out of the same stellar nursery. So they really are sister stars. So I love the Pleiades. But Merope was sometimes in mythology called the Lost Pleiad. She was the faintest of the sisters. And in mythology, that was connected to the fact that she had married a mortal. And so she was kind of shamed and outcast, made dimmer. So sometimes you can't even see her in the sky because she's actually down on Earth with her mortal husband. And I love the connection of that to Merope Gaunt as she became Merope Riddle, marrying Tom Riddle Senior, that Merope the Pleiad married a mortal, Merope the witch married a muggle. And through that became disgraced by her pure blood family and kind of cast out, and also had her magic kind of diminish over time through that kind of shame and loss process.
That's one of those on the nose ones that you were mentioning. That's wow. Spot on.
Yeah. Very but clear. Even at the same time, I've never heard that connection. Which is so interesting because, you know, I don't study, you know, astronomy or astrology very much. And so I think that's really interesting. I just got chills because it's like, wow, that had to be really an interesting, you know, sort of allusion to write, you know, to try to write, you know, this person who's this personification of a star who's been diminished for you know, marrying outside the magic circle, you know.
It's
really interesting. Okay, who else?
I love that. So I mentioned Aurora Sinistra. So Aurora is this kind of celestial event as stellar winds interact with Earth's magnetic field. You get these beautiful Aurora Borealis effects. That's kind of celestial themed. Sinistra, her last name, is actually also a star in the constellation Ophiuchus. Could also be referencing, so Sinistra, same root as sinister, technically means left or left-handed, but also has this association with kind of like darkness or evil, that maybe that's referencing astronomy as being done in the dark, the real dark art, if you will.
I love that, Jane. That needs
OG.
To be the name. That needs to be the name of your article.
The OG real dark art.
Then, of course, we have Luna Lovegood, Luna, referencing the moon and her kind of wackiness, looniness, if you will. We also see, again, I think only mentioned once in Harry's sorting ceremony, there's a another student in Harry's year with the surname of Moon. So we kind of see these names pop up all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, you can just tell, I mean, going back to the Merope thing too, like, you can just tell that she was mining names from astronomy, from like the mythology around the constellations and so on. That is really fascinating. Well, one of the other things that has gotten, I think, more play in Harry Potter criticism is the concept of alchemy and how what J.K. Rowling is doing here. There's a lot of alchemical references, and alchemy is also one of these old sciences. How does astronomy relate to alchemy? And, you know, how should we bring that into our alchemical understanding of Harry Potter?
Yeah. So, as you said, alchemy is a real historical science. This was a real study as people were trying to figure out how to make these kind of transformations, right? So we have our Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone, if you're more historical, or British in the Harry Potter sense, that was transforming metals into gold. So this was a real thing that scientists were trying to understand. So then as an astrophysicist, I come in and I get very excited because I can think about how gold is actually created, how that transformation really occurs in the universe itself. So gold, or any element, is defined by its atomic structure, which is defined by basically how many protons do you have in a nucleus. Starting to get sciencey here, but basically gold is defined as the atomic nucleus that has 79 protons in it. But at the very beginning of the universe, shortly after the Big Bang, all we had was hydrogen, which has one proton in its nucleus, and helium, which has two protons in its nucleus. So everything else in the universe had to be produced some way. And so those all happen through actual astrophysical processes. So stars are a place where this can happen. So basically, to build these heavier elements, anything beyond hydrogen and helium, you have to add more protons to your nucleus. It turns out that adding protons to a nucleus is actually very difficult. So one of the places that this can happen naturally is in the core of stars, that the temperatures and pressures are high enough that you can actually force protons into nuclei. You can force nuclei to combine with each other to create these heavier elements. And so through that process in stars, you can create almost this kind of alchemical process, elements all the way up to iron. But iron only has 26 protons in its nucleus. If we're going by the alchemists of old, our goal is to make gold. So fusion in the cores of stars isn't enough for that. So then you can have supernova explosions when stars explode at the end of their lives, where you can actually add a bunch of neutrons to a nucleus. And when there's too many neutrons, some of them will, again, through this kind of magical transfiguration process, turn themselves into protons. So this is how we can get some heavier elements even beyond that. And for a long time, that's how we thought all the gold in the universe came, was through these supernova explosions. But it was from a fairly recent discovery that we actually found that neutron stars, so neutron stars are the cores that are left over after the supernova explosion. But if you take those cores of those dead stars and you smash them together through binary neutron star mergers, that's the process where there's enough activity going on. Again, you're adding more neutrons to elements that you actually create gold. So I get really excited thinking about alchemy, because the real sorcerer's stone in our universe is actually binary neutron star mergers. This is how all of the gold in the universe, for the most part, was created. So all the gold that we have here on Earth was likely once created in a neutron star merger somewhere out in space in the past.
Wow. Man,
that is fascinating.
I told you we were getting educated. Makes sense.
Yeah. No, you put it really well. Yeah. Yeah, I wish you had been teaching that undergraduate course that I
didn't Thank you for
take.
Coming to my lecture.
Yeah. This has been my TED Talk on gold and alchemy and neutron stars.
Absolutely. Yeah, but so this then ties neat. Into this ties into what you were kind of mentioning earlier when you were saying why you didn't want to take astronomy in college, is you were scared it was a little too astrophysics. Everything I just talked about is definitely astrophysics, where astronomy is kind of looking at motions of the sky. Astrophysics is understanding the physics, the physical phenomena of things that are happening in the universe and in space. But this then leans into, again, my astronomical fan theory of why I think astrophysics is actually worth learning for wizards and perhaps being taught at Hogwarts, is that it can be useful for wizards to understand the roots of nature, right? So we talked a lot about ritual magic. I also want to talk about representational magic, or sometimes called sympathetic magic, nature magic, where you can infuse your magic by looking at like things. So maybe if you're trying to perform alchemy, or you're trying to do some sort of transfiguration or creation magic, infusing that with the knowledge of how that really happens in nature, for example, by the collision of neutron stars in space, and kind of visualizing that and infusing your magic with that, can actually make it more powerful. So this kind of representational magic, just as we might say, We think of water as cool or calming, that you might use water in a spell or a ritual that's trying to achieve that, that knowing some things about the universe and the physics of how the universe works could actually be implemented and infused into magic to make magic more powerful.
I think you're on track to teach at Hogwarts.
I agree. I love how it's all coming together. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, thinking about that, we do have some teachers in this area at Hogwarts.
Absolutely.
And, you know, particularly, although I guess we get some of it with Sybil Trelawney, we really hear it with Firenze, and the centaurs are very interested in astronomy and astrology. So how are those different when the centaurs are doing them, astronomy and astrology? And like, how are the centaurs positioned in relation to those sciences?
I love this question, because one of the interesting things in kind of interpreting and reading the Harry Potter series that I find really interesting is that Sybil Trelawney and divination and astrology is kind of ridiculed even within the magical world. So astrology in our real muggle world can sometimes be kind of scoffed at as being overly procedural or overly predictive and then not being kind of trustworthy. We see that same reflection in ridicule of Professor Trelawney. We see that done by Hermione, of course, who straight up walks out of her divination class. We see Professor McGonagall kind of slyly talk down about divination and Professor Trelawney. We even hear Dumbledore almost talk down about divination a little bit.
Mm-hmm. He seems a little amused by it.
Which is fairly condescending.
Yes. So as an astronomer and an astrophysicist, I sometimes get annoyed with astrology, not because I don't think astrology is cool, but because I don't like it when people confuse astrology and astrophysics. If I say I'm an astronomer and then people ask me about astrological things, I sometimes get a little peeved.
Right. I could see that.
Yeah.
But then what I think is really cool is that when Firenze gets hired to become a divination teacher at Hogwarts, they're talking about, oh, we learned astrology with Professor Trelawney, and we learned that Mars brings these kinds of things, and when it makes an angle to Saturn, you should avoid hot things. And Firenze just shuts that down completely as human nonsense, trivial hurts, tiny human accidents. These are all the things he says. But then goes into his understanding of astrology as much larger, that these tiny, tiny human hurts are insignificant in the view of the cosmos, and tries to connect astrology to larger tides of change and destiny, but also emphasizes the uncertain nature of reading those signs, and that it can take years or decades to know that they've read it correctly, which then I think tunes into this sense of wonder. And so just as I can sometimes be annoyed by astrology in our real world, Firenze and the centaurs bring in this perspective that I really do connect with, of this deeper understanding and this kind of profound sense we get from looking at the sky. So I love that you mentioned that right at the beginning, this spiritual experience of really looking at the stars. And I think that the centaurs bring that in really strongly in their understanding of astrology. That it's not overly procedural, it's not overly predictive. And I try to hold that as an astrophysicist. Most of my relationship with space is very scientific, very mathematical. But one of the reasons I got into astronomy in the first place was that feeling of wonder and inspiration. And so I want to hold that, even as I'm a scientist, to also hold the wonder of staring up at the night sky. I also do paintings that I paint with watercolors and paint the Milky Way or spacescapes, not to be scientifically accurate, but almost as a meditation to keep myself reminded of that wonder. So I love that connection to this kind of spiritual or almost religious aspect. I think astrology in our real muggle world can have that kind of feeling that maybe if someone doesn't feel at home in an organized religion, that astrology is actually a way that you can stay connected to something bigger than yourself. And so I love that aspect of it. And I think that's reflected really nicely by the centaurs.
Yeah, this what you said about how Firenze's just sort of connected into the larger tides. I like that. That, you know, it's not little bitty, but it's really the big picture. And that is what you're getting when you're gazing at the cosmos, right? Mm-hmm. In an astronomical way.
Right. Like maybe it's not all about us and our minutiae.
Yeah. Right.
No, it's lovely. It's great. It's lovely to hear you, as a scientist, draw on feelings of awe and wonder in your work. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, I think religion and science, spirituality and science have a lot to say to each other. But, you mm-hmm. know, it's wonderful to hear somebody actually saying it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jane, for being our guest on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I got to talk about two of my favorite subjects. So this was a blast for me and I was honored to be here. So thank you.
Yeah, this is everything I wanted it to be from when Emily and I were whispering together during your presentation at LeakyCon.
Oh, yeah. And more.
Our closing quote today comes from Order of the Phoenix, the OWL exam in astronomy, during which Umbridge and other ministry officials attempt unsuccessfully to seize Hagrid in full view of the fifth year students on the rooftop of Hogwarts with their telescopes trained not on the stars, but on Hagrid's hut. But before all of that happens, the narrator sets the scene for the astronomy OWL exams at the end of fifth year. When they reached the top of the astronomy tower at 11 o'clock, they found a perfect night for stargazing, cloudless and still. The grounds were bathed in silvery moonlight, and there was a slight chill in the air. Each of them set up his or her telescope, and when Professor Marchbanks gave the word, proceeded to fill in the blank star chart he or she had been given. Wishing you good stargazing, listeners, but also don't forget how starlight illuminates what's happening on Earth.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.